Once upon a time, there was a wicked king who determines to inhibit the development and growth of a race of people who had been brought into his kingdom centuries earlier. His first plan of action is that he enslaves all the people and oppresses them. Utter fail. Their growth continues. Exponentially, they grow in spite of this. Plan B is he issues a chilling edict that all newborn males should die at their birth. First, midwives were to take the lives of the kids, and then when that didn't work, all Egyptians had the right and the obligation to throw newborn Hebrew males into the Nile River. And into this climate of death, a baby boy is born. In a desperate attempt to save the newborn's life, his mother places him in a small ark and sets him afloat on the very river that the king declared a tomb of death for these male children. His big sister, Miriam, stands watch nearby. Miraculously, the evil king's own daughter discovers the crying Hebrew child, has compassion on him, rescues him from his deadly fate, and adopts him into the royal family of the king who made the deathly edict. At the suggestion of the child's lurking big sister, she even hires his own biological mother to raise and nurture the boy until the appropriate time when he becomes a royal prince in the most powerful kingdom on earth. Yada, 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 Moses grows up. That's kind of how the text reads today. All that happens, reads like a fairy tale, and then Exodus 2:11, one day when Moses had grown up. Part of the reason the text reads this way is because the story that we find in Exodus is ultimately not a story about Moses. It's not about a wicked Pharaoh. It's not about a desperate mom. It's not about a resourceful sister or a compassionate princess or a Hebrew baby turned Egyptian prince. As we said in week one, the story of the Exodus is about God, an all-powerful, constantly working behind the scenes, sovereignly in control, merciful and active God. So each character, each scene, each plot twist, each development, each turn in this story is crafted by a divine author who is writing a redemptive story of ultimate rescue that will actually take place over thousands of years of time. Check out how the narrative develops in Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. One day when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. From Acts chapter 7, verse 23, we learn that Moses is now a 40-year-old man when this event takes place. And unless you think Charlton Heston's portrayal of Moses in Cecil DeMille's famous The Ten Commandments is history, we really do not know anything about his pre-40 life, except that he was raised with the obvious privileges of being a royal prince. I say that because The Ten Commandments has this whole story about Moses as a boy and a young adult. But what we read is that Moses goes out after he's an adult, 40 years of age. He goes out. By the way, this go out language that's used in the specific text serves kind of as this ongoing refrain throughout Exodus and the Old Testament to describe how God brought his people out of Egypt. And so this is kind of step one in this bigger divine story, that Moses goes out of Egypt himself. Literally, we will see as the story unfolds that God is writing a redemptive story, and it is filled with flawed and unqualified and sinful characters. From all indications, Moses is more than aware of his Hebrew pedigree at this point. I mentioned last week that he was probably raised by his own mother to understand who he was and the heritage from which he came. And from this incident, we also discover that Moses is a man full of compassion and courage, who identifies with and aligns himself with this enslaved people group, the Hebrews. Moses is saying in this event, I'm one of them. I'm a Hebrew. I'm an Israelite. He identifies with them. And so Moses goes out and he witnesses one of his fellow Israelites. So the phrase that the Bible uses, the English translation, is beating the other. Now, that means like physically beating, not like they were playing cards or dominoes or in a foot race or 101. It means like he was physically like beating him. And he decides to act with this Egyptian taskmaster beating this Israelite. And so he decides to act on this. And so he looks both ways before crossing the street. No, he looks both ways in order to make sure supposedly no one is watching. Kills this Egyptian and then buries his body in the sand. So this is the first, and let's admit, not the smartest attempt at Moses to deliver his people. Not a wise move here to just physically assault and kill a taskmaster. I mean, you're not going to set a million plus people free by taking out this taskmaster, right? So not his smartest move to deliver his people. He acts alone in secret, relying on his own strength and craftiness, and his plan fails miserably. And it sounds very familiar when this happens. The tendency to take matters into our own hands, to seek to write our own storyline, to figure things out on our own, kind of inserting our plan into the mix, failing to wait on God, attempting to try harder, to do better, to figure it out on our own. Like, we are Moses, it just looks different, right? We tend to take matters into our own hands as life unfolds. Verse 13, obviously the secret was not a secret as he thought. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid, and he thought, surely the thing is known. So next day, Moses intervenes in another conflict, this time between two Hebrews. And he's basically saying, like, why are you guys beating up on each other? Like, your fellow Hebrew is not the enemy here. Why are you beating up each other? And in a typical alpha male response, the dudes are like, who put you in charge over us? You're not the judge. You're not the arbitrator. You're not the prince over us. Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? To which Moses responded, I might. No, he didn't. Instead, he said, ruh-roh, right? Someone knows my secret. I thought no one knew, but they know. The secret is out. The Hebrews are not as welcoming of Moses' transition from Egyptian prince to Hebrew liberator as he might have hoped. As a matter of fact, the opposite is true. His plan backfires. They reject Moses in this moment as their liberator. And we're going to find this recurring theme again and again in Exodus, that Israel is in constant rebellion, even within their own ranks. They're in constant rebellion. And they are constantly rejecting Moses as their deliverer. From the beginning, Moses' role as the rescuer, the deliverer, is met with his people rejecting him, constantly questioning his authority. And because God is the author of this story, their rejection of Moses, we'll read and discover as we go through Exodus, is essentially a rejection of God. He's the author of this story. And so the secret is out, and as you might imagine, Moses is going to find himself in trouble. Verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So Pharaoh, the king, learns of this incident, and he wants to kill Moses, who in his mind is a turncoat. And Moses is afraid for his life, so he flees to the land of Midian, and again, yada, 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 he sits down at a well. God is writing a story. Now, this is a side note for Bible nerds. The Midianites brought Joseph, remember that story, to exile into Egypt. Midianites brought Joseph 400 years earlier into exile in Egypt. Now, Moses winds up with the Midianites, same group, after his exile from Egypt. God is writing a story. A second side note here. Moses' departure from Egypt into the desert in this moment. Moses leaves Egypt, flees into the desert, is a foreshadow, even though he doesn't know it or realize it, it is a foreshadow of what is to come. The entire Exodus event, 40 years later, all of Israel will exit Egypt into the desert because God is crafting a story. He's writing a story of deliverance one chapter at a time. In this instant, in 40-year intervals, 0 to 40, Moses is in Egypt, living in the palace. Miraculous story about how he ends up a royal prince. 40 years, he's in Egypt. The next 40 years, Moses is out of Egypt. He's driven out of Egypt into the desert over the next 40 years. 40 years later, Moses returns to Egypt and brings all of Israel out of Egypt. And so God is writing, he's crafting this redemptive story. One chapter, one scene at a time, God is in absolute control. Verse 16. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. Pause a moment just to think about that. Seven daughters. I have two. Seven daughters. Next phrase in the text. And he forbid them from ever being contestants on The Bachelor. No. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses, you might remember who's sitting by the well, stood up and saved them and watered their flock. And when they came home to their father Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian, and obviously this is from Moses' garb, his clothing and mannerisms, maybe even his language, because he's a Hebrew by birth, right? They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of, here's the language again, out of the hand of the shepherds. He's a rescuer. He's delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. He said to his daughters, then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. So in this section of the text, there's a couple of points worth noting here in this part of the story that are crucial throughout our series. Again, Moses by his nature is a rescuer. He is a deliverer. He is compassionate. He is courageous. When he sees injustice, he intervenes. He is quick to act on behalf of the oppressors, right? Seven daughters here. We don't know how big this group of shepherds were, but Moses had enough of a fear factor about him and an intimidation factor where, man, he stands up. He goes after these guys and chases them away. Maybe it was just his male testosterone that was like seven daughters gave him the courage to do it. We don't know like the true motive here. We just know he's a man of compassion, man of courage, by nature, a rescuer, a deliverer. Don't forget that. He's a guy that acts out of compassion, out of courage. He sees injustice. He goes after. He intervenes. He is quick to act on behalf of the oppressed. Great trait to have, right? We'll see how that kind of unfolds in Moses' life. Don't forget also in this section of the story, we're kind of introduced to this idea that Moses finds acceptance outside of his own people. This is part of Moses' life. He found acceptance in Pharaoh's home. He was not an Egyptian, not a royal prince in any way, and yet he was accepted for at least the first 40 years of his life in Pharaoh's palace, in Pharaoh's home. Now he's finding acceptance in Midian. He's not a Midianite. This is a group that was at odds with Israel through a lot of their history. But now he's in Midian. He finds acceptance there. As a matter of fact, he marries a Midianite lady. He has a son with her. He settles down, the text says. So he's finding his groove in life outside of his homeland, Egypt, outside of his home people, Israel. He's beginning to find acceptance outside of his people. Yet, he's a man of exile. He is a wanderer. He names his son Gershom, which means alien or a permanent banished, the idea of permanent banishment. And so his own son, his name reminds him that he's a fugitive. He's been banished. He is an exile from his homeland, Egypt, from his people, Israel. And so you can see again what God's doing here. Moses is beginning to identify, to sympathize with God's people. When he acted in Egypt, killed the Egyptian, tried to intervene in the lives of the two Hebrews, Moses was a royal prince. He had no clue what the Israelites went through. He watched it from afar. He's a man of compassion and courage. So he identifies with his people. He empathizes with them, but he doesn't really understand what's going on. And you can see it from their response. Who are you? Why? You're not our prince. You're not our judge. Go back to your palace. But now God's writing a story. He's a wanderer. He's an exile. For 40 years, God puts him in a position where he begins to identify with God's people. You see how God's writing this story? God is positioning Moses as the right man for this task. Moses does not even know it, but God knows it. From Moses' point of view, he's permanently banished from both his homeland and his people. Think about it. Moses has failed as a deliverer. He's failed as a prince. He's a wanted killer. He's a fugitive. He is a resident in an obscure place. He is by nature a compassionate and courageous rescuer, but his situation provides him no opportunity for his calling. He has messed the whole thing up. But again, the story is not about Moses. The story is about a God who uses failures and outcasts and people running from their problems, people who have been banished from what is comfortable, from their homes. It is a story about a God who uses obscure people who do not feel that they have a place in his story. Moses is not the author of this story. God is the author. Moses is not writing this story. God is writing the story. And the story that God is writing is a story about God. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, 23, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. So during this 40-year window, the king of Egypt dies. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help. And so the text kind of indicates that maybe they thought the Pharaoh is dead, things will change. They realize things are not changing, and so they're at the kind of bottom of the barrel. They don't know what else to do. They're groaning because of their slavery. They're crying out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Pharaoh dies. God's people are miserable and desperate, and it's time for God to act. the behind-the-scenes God of Exodus 1 and most of Exodus 2 is about to step into the spotlight. Now, notice the sequence of events here. The people groan and they cry out to God. They begin to pray. They invite God in to their situation. Again, we're talking about centuries of time here. You imagine the amount of time, just we don't know how long they were, have been enslaved, but it's been at least a window of time that they've been oppressed and have been enslaved, and they have, that's become their identity of who they are, and they're crying out to God. They have reached a place in life where the only thing they know how to do is to pray. You ever been there? Have you ever been at a place in your life where the only thing you knew to do was to pray, to invite God into the situation? I don't know what else to do. I don't know what steps to take. I don't know how this is going to work out. Our tendency is to wait until that moment, isn't it? When we're groaning and miserable, that's when we tend to invite God in. We tend to live life like Moses, trying to figure things out on our own, take matters into our own hands. And then when we keep hitting the wall, or everything gets knocked out from under us, or we've lost everything, or everything's been stripped from us, we've finally reached the place where pride has been kind of stripped away, that's when we tend to invite God in. Now, I want to tell you this, not in a word of admonishment, but I want to tell you that as a word of encouragement, because here's what I want you to hear me say. In those moments, God still hears and acts and responds. God's not sitting in heaven like, so now you want to come to me? Now you want to cry out to me? Now you want to pray? Now you want to invite me in? We serve a God who is eager to respond and to act in compassion and mercy and grace and forgiveness. He is not reluctant. He is not hesitant to respond to his people. He is eager by his very nature of who he is to respond and to hear and to act. And they begin to pray. And God hears, and God remembers, and God acts. God hears, God sees, God knows. And now, let me qualify something here. This language, God remembered his covenant. It's very important that remember here is not the idea of recalling. It's not like God had forgotten them, and then suddenly it dawned on him. Oh, I totally forgot about them. What have I been doing up here? Managing the world. I forgot about Israel. That's not what we're talking about when it says God remembered. God is all-knowing. God does not forget. He retains all truth about all things at all times with perfect knowledge. Some of your women think, like, my husband thinks that about himself. He remembers all things at all times with all knowledge. It's actually true about God. He knows all things at all times, about everything at the same time. So there's no forgetting in a sovereign God who is above time. Remember here is covenant language. It's relational language. He says, I remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This remembering is not an alternative to forgetting. It's an alternative to forsaking, to abandoning. In other words, God will not forsake his people. He will hear them, he will see them, he will know that they are there, and he will act. He is faithful to his promises. Even after 400 years, his promises are still valid. As a matter of fact, the last verse in that chapter of chapter 2, kind of the best rendering of the text there in 25, is that God looked on them and made himself known to them. It's time for God to show up. The stage has been set. And we'll start diving into that in chapter 3. So let me end today with some connections here between Moses and Jesus, who is our true Redeemer. We've already heard in the Exodus series how their births are related. But what about Exodus chapter 2, Moses? What do we learn about Jesus and Moses from Exodus 2? The first thing I would just remind us of is that Jesus is the greater rescuer. Jesus is the great rescuer of his people. Moses decides to take matters into his own hands, to initiate liberation, and he fails miserably. He did not wait on God nor follow God's plan of rescue. And as I mentioned, we tend to be like Moses. We are prone to take matters into our own hands, especially when it seems like God's a little quiet, or he's removed, or he seems maybe a little unconcerned with my situation. I got this, God. I got this. I'm going to do better. I'm going to try harder. I'm going to set a schedule. I'm going to get up earlier. I'm going to pray harder. I'm going to stop doing all these things and start doing all these things. We tend to be like Moses. We are prone to take matters into our own hands. Think about Jesus. Jesus followed perfectly the Father's rescue plan. As a matter of fact, he even prayed on the most pivotal and difficult night of his life, "Not my will be done, but yours be done." Jesus exercised perfect obedience and submission to the Father's will, even when he felt abandoned at the deepest level. Abandoned as a human in the garden, abandoned by his friends and disciples, abandoned by his family, abandoned by the Heavenly Father on the cross. He did not take matters into his own hands. He followed the will of the Father. And his perfect obedience, by the way, is part of what makes him the better and ultimate redeemer for us, the rescuer. Moses was compassionate. Moses was courageous. The New Testament says he was mighty in word and deed, but he was prone to act in his own strength, own wisdom, own power, without relying on the source of his strength, wisdom, and power. And we each have a tendency to rely upon our own human resources to try and make things happen in our life, don't we? To move the chess pieces of life in our favor. In our ways. If you're like me, I want quick and simple solutions to life's problems. We're an instant coffee world, aren't we? I want to wait 45 minutes on my coffee. I want to hit the button and have hot coffee in a moment's time. And I tend to approach life that way. I want quick and easy solutions that I can handle and I can control. Or I'm in charge, that I'm leading, that I'm kind of rescuing myself. And we are constantly trying to make our stories about us. And the scriptures remind us, trust in the Lord with all your heart. And do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. And what? And he will make your path straight. He will direct your life. You are not the rescuer. You need a rescuer. You are not the deliverer. You need a deliverer, but it's not you. And the good news of the gospel is that Jesus is the ultimate rescuer. That he lived in perfect obedience, that he did what we were unable and incapable of doing, and that he is faithful to his people. That our story on earth is not about us. It is about him. Now, in our culture and everything we're told from knee up as an American about pursue this and pursuit of happiness and life and all those things, right? We live in a culture where we are bombarded that life's about you. That everything's about you and your happiness and your satisfaction and your ability to climb the ladder. But we learn over and over and over and over again in Scripture, life's not about us. We are a part of his story. His story of rescue and redemption. He is the author and finisher of our faith. And so we look to him because he is the greater rescuer of his people. And then I just want to bring this up from this part of the text. It's such a beautiful reminder in this text that Jesus also faced rejection. He faced it. He faced rejection by his own people. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen is delivering a message, and he makes a connection between the rejection of Moses by the people of Israel and the rejection of Jesus. He makes this connection that Moses, the leader, the deliverer, the rescuer, was constantly rejected by his people, constantly questioning his authority. Jesus was also rejected. Now, check this out. Jesus was not an amateur rescuer like Moses. He was the Son of God. God the Son who came to earth. So you might expect the possibility of rejection to be, we'll just say, improbable for the Son of God. He's God robed in the flesh. Why are we going to reject God? Yet the scriptures make clear, we'll use John's gospel here, that he came to his own and they did not receive him. That the life of Jesus was marked constantly by rejection. In his birth, he was rejected. They had to flee, become fugitives on the run. In his life, he was constantly rejected by the people who claimed to love and befriend him. In his death, he faced the ultimate rejection. Even the Heavenly Father turning his back on him on the cross, where Jesus would cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? His life was marked by rejection. Isaiah the prophet said he was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He faced the scorn and the sting of rejection so that we might find acceptance through him and in him. Jesus was the ultimate and perfect Redeemer who was scorned and rejected so that those, listen, who scorned him and rejected him might be rescued by him. So, if you're feeling a little rejected today, a little alone, abandoned, scorned, ridiculed, despised, if you're feeling a little unheard, unseen, invisible, no. There is a man of sorrows who became one of us in every respect, Hebrews says, so that he might be a merciful and faithful Redeemer. What I want you to hear me say today is he understands. He sympathizes. He gets it. Whatever you're feeling, whatever feelings of rejection and scorn or ridicule or I'm invisible, no one sees me, no one hears me, my spouse doesn't hear what I'm saying, my kids don't get me, my coworkers are constantly making fun of me, I feel rejected, I feel abandoned, I feel lonely, I feel single and no one cares. Whatever you're feeling today in these arenas of life, I want you to know that Jesus understands. He hears, he sees, he gets it. It's what makes him the ultimate and perfect Redeemer. You are not rejected in Jesus. You are accepted in him. You are not abandoned by him. You are loved by him. You are not scorned and ridiculed. You are embraced and valued. You are not despised. You are esteemed in Christ. You are not unheard. You are heard. You are not unknown, but you are known by God himself. You're not forsaken because he will never leave us or forsake us. Jesus faced rejection. He faced your rejection on a cross. And God is faithful to his promises. You are known by him. He knows, he acts, He has not forgotten you. He has not forsaken you. He is faithful to his covenant. So the little Bible storybook that we use most often with Levi as we're helping him navigate the stories of Scripture is the Jesus Storybook Bible. If you've had your child dedicated at City Church, we've given you that as a gift. And in the Jesus Storybook Bible, here is how covenant is defined. That covenant is a never-stopping, never-giving-up, unbreaking, always and forever love. I love that definition. Never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. Hear me. If you belong to Jesus, that is the type of love that he has for you today. Never stopping, never giving up, unbreakable, always and forever love. I cited for you earlier John's gospel. He came to his own, and his own would not receive him. They rejected him. Do you know how the rest of that verse plays out? But, sharp contrast, right? He came into his own rejected him. They turned from him. They would not receive him. But, John says, but, there's a rest of this story. There's another side of this. He came into his own and they would not receive him. They rejected him. But to those who did receive him, to those who did believe in his name, to those who are his people, he gave them the right to become children of God. Those who rejected him. He came to his own and they rejected him. But to those who do receive him, to those who do call on his name, to those who do believe in his name, to them, to his people, he has given the right to be called sons of God and daughters of God. And always, never ending, never stopping, unbreakable love.